supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Grapple, and I'm Naomi Steroven. As we've heard on the show so far, America is grappling with some major issues right now. From deindustrialization to growing income inequality, the United States is undergoing profound economic and social changes. And immigration has especially become a hot-button topic that played out in the 2016 presidential election. So on today's show, we're going to break down America's changing demographics with journalist Maria Hinojosa, whose recent work focuses on this issue.
You know, 10 years ago, remember, it was actually the boom. Things were kind of looking up. And immigrants, we were not the focus of the ire, even though at that time was when there was a tremendous amount of focus on constructing immigrant detention centers that, you know, now exist across our country. So it wasn't full frontal the way it is now.
But first, let's hear from Dan Hopkins. He's a political scientist at the University of Pennsylvania, and he researches what contributes to anti-immigration politics. We met with Hopkins in his office the day after Donald Trump won the presidency, and we talked about how immigration played out in the election.
Immigration is an issue that has become central to the politics of America, quite clearly, even before this election. But not only America, Britain, Denmark, countries across the developed world have been really grappling with the challenges that come from incorporating large numbers of immigrants. So one of the natural questions that then comes up is, when native-born populations are worried about immigration, what are the source of those concerns? Is it that those born in this country, for instance, are concerned that immigrants might compete with them economically, might cost them their job? Or is it more that native-born Americans are worried that immigrants might threaten what it means to be American, that they might in some ways reshape American identity? This is a question that I've done a lot of research on. And overall, research suggests that attitudes towards immigration are not strongly grounded in job market concerns. That is to say, people are not particularly concerned about immigrants, for instance, who have the same profession that they do. So researchers pretty quickly have identified that economic self-interest, at least in a narrow sense, is probably not the engine behind a lot of the contemporary concern about immigration. So the question then is, what is it?
Turns out that Americans' concerns about immigration may have more to do with issues around identity and language than most people would think.
One possibility is that it's more symbolic, that it's a set of concerns about how immigration is reshaping what it means to be American. And scholars who adopt that view often will point to concerns around, for instance, language. That if you talk to Americans about immigration, one of the first things that comes up is often the use of Spanish or other non-English languages. And that is a source of real concern, and I think is indicative of many Americans thinking that immigration makes it harder for us to stay united as a people. And that, and one thing to be clear about is that the evidence actually suggests that today's immigrants are incorporating and adopting the English language, for instance, at rates that are roughly comparable to the adoption of English by Italian immigrants or other immigrants who didn't initially speak English 100 years ago. But the public perception is very much that we have today growing immigrant populations, not all of whom are interested in assimilating and adopting a set of American norms, chief among them being the English language.
So compared to previous generations, it seems Americans today are reacting no differently to immigration.
I would argue that reactions today are in some important ways very similar to those. So we had significant waves of immigration in the, in the 1840s and 1850s, then in the 1880s and 1890s. And the immigration in the 1880s and 1890s included a lot of people from Southern Europe, so Italians, also from Eastern Europe, Jewish immigrants, Polish immigrants. And they were met with fierce hostility. This was a time when it's hard now to imagine, but Irish immigrants were viewed very negatively. Italian immigrants were viewed very negatively. Jewish immigrants were viewed very negatively. They were seen as, bringing communism, bringing anarchism, and generally threats to public well-being. And then their arrival catalyzed a profound anti-immigrant movement in American politics that culminated in three different immigration acts that dramatically restricted immigration outside of the Western Hemisphere from the 1920s until 1965. So I think what many of us, in light of Donald Trump's stunning victory, I think what many of us are now wondering is, have we reached 1921? Have we reached 1924? Have we reached a point when American public policy is going to turn dramatically against continued immigration? Does Donald Trump and does the rise of anti-immigrant rhetoric really change that in a powerful way? And it's possible that the real changes have yet to be manifest.
And as part of his research, Hopkins has developed what he calls the politicized places hypothesis to better understand what contributes to the rise of anti-immigration politics.
Well, my research has found, both looking at the attitudes of non-Hispanic white American citizens and also looking at where you see local anti-immigration political activities, say anti-immigration ordinances or the like, is that they tend to appear under two conditions. One we've been talking about, which is sudden demographic changes, destabilizing demographic changes that lead a lot of people to say, this doesn't feel like my community in the way that my community used to feel. But there's another element to the story. If you think back to the 1990s, the late 1990s were a period when immigration was increasing dramatically and a lot of communities in what we refer to as new immigrant destinations were cropping up, that is to say, places where immigrants had not traditionally gone, but suddenly you see large immigrant communities emerging in northwest Arkansas to work in chicken plants, or in various parts of North Carolina, in suburban Washington, in Nassau and Suffolk County in New York. And so those sudden changes both destabilized local norms, but I think the second piece of this politicized places argument, which I've made, is that you don't need just demographic changes. You also need political rhetoric that can help people make sense of what these changes mean politically and how they relate to your political life. When people can turn on their televisions or look on their computer screens and be exposed to salient political rhetoric, which helps them then make sense of immigration and put a name and a set of labels to the challenges they're seeing in their day-to-day lives. It helps them start to connect the Spanish that they see at the grocery store to a broader political movement.
Hopkins says he was struck by the number of what he calls symbolic issues that came up in the election, from immigration to white identity.
I want to state unequivocally that attitudes about social groups and attitudes about race are central in how people understand immigration. And partly what Donald Trump and his ascendance within the Republican Party and now within American politics has done is to realign politics just on the margins, right? I mean, most people who voted for Barack Obama voted for Hillary Clinton. Most people who voted for Mitt Romney voted for Donald Trump. But on the margins, Donald Trump has succeeded in reorienting politics such that people's immigration attitudes and their prejudices are now more predictive of how they're voting than they were 4 years ago. One way in which you could make sense of this election is as having brought unusual prominence to symbolic issues, issues that tell us which groups are up and which groups are down, issues about group status and group position. This election has, in some very powerful ways, upended some of the political conventional wisdom, and conventional wisdom that's very easy to hold from the offices of, a professor in Washington, D.C., or Philadelphia, or New York City, in that slowly, over time, election by election, we're seeing a more diverse electorate, right? Younger generations are much more diverse, and surveys indicate more comfortable in a diverse world. But that said, the changes that are wrought by demographics are very, very slow moving. And in any given election, you can see dramatic swings in either direction. So in this election, we've seen an unusual politicization of white identity and of immigrant identity, of a number of different group identities. And at the same time, the underlying demographic trends are pointing in a direction such that a Trump-style candidacy would be increasingly improbable. But that didn't make it in any way impossible in this election year. And so I would caution us against any simplistic explanation that says Trump represents the rise of racism or the resurgence of racism to the exclusion of other factors. I think undeniably that there is a racial meaning to Trump's election that is understood by non-Hispanic whites, by African Americans, by Latinos, that we did not see in the prior election. And so voters who embrace a more cosmopolitan America move towards Hillary Clinton. Voters who do not move towards Donald Trump. So I would caution us against reading this election as any one story. I think any election is going to be a kind of collage of a wide variety of stories, but also undeniably questions of race and group status and the meaning of white identity in a changing world have to be central when we're talking about what happened in this election.
Now let's turn to journalist Maria Hinojosa to hear more about America's changing demographics. Hinojosa is the founder of the Futuro Media Group that produces NPR's Latino USA and a podcast called In the Thick that looks at politics, race, and the recent presidential election. She's the host for all three programs, and she joins us now from the studios of the Futuro Media Group in New York City. Welcome, Maria.
Hey, good to be here.
So you were born in Mexico, grew up in Chicago, you went to school in New York City, you've traveled all over the country as a journalist, you now live and work in Harlem. Given all these experiences, what sticks out to you most about how America has changed over the course of your lifetime?
I suppose one of the simple answers would be that when I was growing up as a Mexican kid on the south side of Chicago in the middle of the civil rights era, you know, my family, we consumed a tremendous amount of media. We were like all Americans. We were watching Meet the Press. We were watching the evening news. My dad was reading Time magazine. But we were invisible. Our stories were invisible. People like me were invisible from any of the stories that were being told. And certainly there was no one who looked like me or sounded like me who was delivering the news. So I grew up essentially feeling pretty invisible, never ever in my life thinking that I could be smart enough to be a journalist. Fast forward now to this many years later, and we're not invisible now. And I'm running my own media company. And the numbers, you know, America by the Numbers is our television series on PBS, and the data shows what has happened in terms of the demographic changes in our country. So that's like a lot of movement forward. But sadly, and this is what gets really weird, especially if you are, or, you know, specifically a Latino or Latina or an immigrant, you know, we're kind of in a place where we're now being targeted as problems, as a community that takes and doesn't give, that can be insulted. So there's been a tremendous amount of progress. You know, I'm a product of that. I'm a manifestation of it. I'm a manifestation of saying, you know what? I'm going to own who I am as an American woman, as an American journalist, as an American entrepreneur. But at the same time, I don't know if I've ever felt as an American journalist so as and my persona, who I am, a mom, Mexican immigrant, you know, living in Harlem, I don't know if I've ever felt this much kind of attack also.
So had we had this conversation 5-10 years ago, you would have had a different answer for me, sounds like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, 10 years ago, remember, it was actually the boom. Things were kind of looking up. And immigrants, we were not the focus of the ire, even though at that time was when there was a tremendous amount of focus on constructing immigrant detention centers that, you know, now exist across our country. So it wasn't full frontal the way it is now.
And what do you attribute the change to?
You know, if I put on my journalist hat, I would say that one of the biggest problems is that we haven't really had a truly diverse mainstream media in the United States. What do I mean? Well, there are statistics that have come out that say that there's a possibility that there is less diversity now in American newsrooms than there was 20 years ago. So I think the media, the lack of diversity of the media, the way the media, and we're talking in broad strokes, you know, kind of created a narrative around these outsiders coming in. You do not want to have a situation where the fastest growing demographic groups, Asian and Latino, somehow feel like they're not a part of the country. That's not good, not just for them. It's not going to be good for our democracy when they're the majority, right? To go back to that term. It's not going to be good for our democracy, for all of us. Not just for them, but for all of us.
By the 2040s, white America will no longer be the majority. What does this mean? And what does it mean now that we are projecting this 20 plus years into the future?
Well, so let's start with now. 2016, the electorate now is the most diverse in our country's history. One in three, 31% of the eligible voters will be non-white. Another number that does correlate in terms of race, but actually is an age issue, which is that for the first time, millennials, 18 to 35, are the largest generation in our country, right? You know, 50% of our cities already have a majority non-white population. You know, since 2011, over 50% of the births in the United States have been to people of color. You look at our kindergarten rooms, now, one of every four kindergartners now is Latino. So that's what it looks like now. And I guess basically what we say, what I've been actually saying in a lot of my speeches around the country is, so why do we fear who we already are? That's a question that I really am fascinated by. Like, if we actually look at ourselves, this is who the United States of America is. All of our kids, our grandkids, you know, they're already doing this. They're already kind of living in this world. And it is the older generation, I think. I've actually heard them referred to as maybe this older white America feels like they're the new immigrants. They're now in a country that in some ways they look around and they're like, where are we? What happened? And so a tremendous amount of compassion and understanding for them, because I get that, like, change is not easy. But at the same time, it's the opening up of the dialogue that I think is really going to help us. And the media, of course, plays a huge role in all of this.
Can you tell us about communities you've seen in your travels around the United States where the white population has decreased, immigrants moved in, and, you know, some of the news stories are people feel threatened, it's not going well. Others are, in fact, they've revitalized communities. It's happened in Pennsylvania. We've done stories about it. Can you talk about some of those communities?
It's happening everywhere across the country. I was in Nebraska, actually, in Omaha, and there's a lot of tension in certain areas around Nebraska. In other parts of Nebraska, they're very, very open. We did a big story on Latino USA about the town of Fremont that made it illegal to rent an apartment to a person who was not, who couldn't produce legal documents. But if you go to this one community, but you take a turn and all of a sudden you're on this street that is like, you know, the Latino street of Omaha, and it's like bopping and popping. You know, there's like color and there's stores and there's bustle. And it's, you know, there's, of course, a party store, you know, where you can buy everything that you need for your kid's birthday or the quinceañera or the wedding. There were restaurants. There was color. And, you know, it's not to say that the rest of Omaha isn't vibrant. It is. But it was just like, wow, this is happening here. You know, but on the other hand, you go to a community where we were recently reporting for America by the Numbers, which is Orange County, California, and, you know, some of the little towns in this area where they were, you know, almost all white 30 years ago, Ronald Reagan territory, and where now the majority population is Asian or a combination of Asian and Latino. And what we thought we would never see in a place like Orange County, strong Republican, Ronald Reagan, and it's like turning into this very diverse place where, you know, Asians and Latinos are increasingly supporting the Democratic Party And so it's changing Orange County, but it's revitalizing it in a way that, you know, we didn't expect, because the other people who are running and winning in Orange County are Asian American women on the Republican Party ticket. So it's all really complex, and we don't know where it's going to end up. But it is about all of us being and feeling like we can be engaged.
Can you talk a little bit, maybe think about one of these places or two of these places and exactly what's happening? How is the revitalization taking place? What are immigrants doing that other people weren't doing?
So, you know, to pick one and say, like, this is the way it looks, actually, I see this across the board. And so what it looks like is, it looks like a community where there was an economic downturn, where there was, let's say, white flight, where, you know, certain industrial jobs have disappeared, but where other different kinds of industry appear, like, let's say, you know, a chicken processing plant or something like that, that draws these workers, which, by the way, they don't end up there on their own, okay? Like, there's a major effort to recruit undocumented workers because they are affordable. So what happens is that these people displace themselves. They buy into, like, come take this job in, you know, some, you know, godforsaken city that they've never heard of or town. And then they end up staying, right? So all of it, to me, really comes down to, can we accept the fact that we have always been a country of immigrants, except for our Native American peoples and the slaves who were brought here against their will? So it's unfortunate that we, as a country, haven't been able to grapple sufficiently enough with accepting who we are and really seriously enjoying the benefits of all of us being here without fear.
So what do you say to people when, you know, you hear this complaint that immigrants are taking our jobs, they're taking their jobs? You know, it's a common refrain. How do you react to that?
What we know right now is that, let's just take the case of Georgia, for example. What ended up happening in Georgia is that Latino immigrants came in. They started getting jobs in the businesses and the factories that were difficult to work for, whether it's, you know, poultry, whether it's lumber, carpets. And as these workers came in and started getting these positions, you know, the whole Georgia economy was actually growing. So those workers who may have been displaced or lost their job, although it never really kind of looks that way, but, you know, for the sake of the argument, may have felt displaced by a new immigrant worker. What ends up happening is actually those people end up moving up in the labor ladder, so that the jobs that they may have taken, now other jobs are open for them and they have more skills and they can compete. And so, you know, maybe they end up moving up the employment rung. So that is kind of the way it looks. But the truth is that we can't gloss over the fact that there will be some people who feel and who may have, in fact, lost their job. But statistically, you know, across the country, it's a much smaller number than the conversation is put out there, or that the narrative has been put out there.
One of the things we're seeing in Pennsylvania, as we report on distressed cities, is that, you know, distressed cities have the ability to attract immigrants because there's often very good housing value there. There's low crime in some of these places. And then we also take a look at leaders and policies, and we ask ourselves and ask them, and we talk about, are leaders welcoming immigrants? Are they seeing it as a strategy to improve their communities? Or are they playing it neutral, or even worse? So what are you seeing around the country? Are leaders embracing the welcoming of immigrants as a way to turn communities around?
I actually want to start off talking about the word distressed, because, I mean, distressed almost makes it feel like it's their fault, like they've done something wrong because they live in a distressed place. And having lived in communities that could fall under that identification, I would say it's an abandoned community. It's a community or a city or a town or a neighborhood that actually services, and that means everything from a bank to a pharmacy to a coffee shop, have basically ditched the place, moved out, and abandoned. And yet we're told that we live in a distressed place. It became distressed because somebody abandoned it. Institutions abandoned it. You know, we talk about institutional racism. That's what it looks like. Like, literally, we're out. You know, this place is not white enough for us to stay. And now it's your fault, and you live in a distressed community. There are places across the country where local officials have understood that this is, you know, something that you want to jump in and grow. And I think that what you're seeing is both a younger generation and an older generation of politically savvy people who, again, are walking away from all the kind of emotional arguments and really looking at numbers and data. Just to give you an example, this is not a story about a city. It's a story about a college in northern Illinois, where the new president of that college actually had been in Kentucky, comes to northern Illinois. He sits me down and he says, you know, I just want to tell you what my financial plan is for this entire college that's been around for 150 years. And I said, well, what is your financial plan for the future? And he says, it's all based on Latino and Latina enrollment. And I was like, what? And he says, that's the fastest growing demographic turning 18. We need to get them. If we get them now, then we get their kids. And that's like the basis of his major economic plan to keep this college afloat. If you have that kind of vision, think what you can do. And by the way, his admissions officer was kind of like, hey, boss, so does that mean you want me to learn Spanish? Yuck, yuck, yuck. And the president of the university looked at him and said, yes, and I'm not laughing. So can we do that without feeling afraid or not?
Thanks for joining us, Maria.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you so much for your work.
Maria Hinojosa is the host and executive producer of the PBS series America by the Numbers, and also of NPR's Latino USA, and a new political podcast called In the Thick. It focuses on politics, race, and the presidential election. All three are produced by the Futuro Media Group, which Hinojosa founded. And that wraps up our show. Thanks so much for listening to Grapple, and we really appreciate you spreading the word about the show. We're going to be taking a break for the next few months to work on new episodes to bring you. Let us know what you'd like to hear on future episodes and how we can get better. Tweet us using the hashtag Grapple or email us at thegrapplepodcast@gmail.com. Grapple is produced by Keystone Crossroads in association with Cuvenda Media. Support for Keystone Crossroads comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The music on our show is composed by Tony Trove and Mike Vivas. Special thanks to WHYY's Diana Martinez for engineering our show, and to Charlie Kyer for his help post-production. Our executive producer is Stephanie Marudis of Cuvenda Media. And I'm Naomi Steroben, editor of Keystone Crossroads. Thanks for listening.